If you have ever done any teaching, or if you have ever been around small children, you know that sometimes in the middle of a deep conversation about some important subjects, the subject gets randomly changed, right? You know, some of you know what I'm talking about. You know, the eyes glaze over. You know, you're into this big explanation to a 4 or 5 year old, and the eyes glaze over, and they come out with something like my own son Ryan did one time from the back seat of a car. I am a young youth pastor. One of my first times addressing the whole congregation, and I'm nervous, and I'm, you know, intensely going over the sermon in my mind. And Ryan and Brett are having an interesting conversation in the back seat, and Ryan says, "Dad, do bees poop in the woods?" You know, just totally random from what I was thinking about, and you know that that's the truth, because you know, and this is a common experience, because people are way more interested in what they're thinking about, or where they are, you know, where they are in life sometimes, than whatever you're talking about. So this is one of those instances. It's happened before. It'll happen again. As Jesus is preaching, he's been preaching about some incredibly powerful subjects. I mean, we're talking heaven and hell. We're talking about God's care for his own people. We're talking about avoiding hypocrisy and other, you know, weighty, weighty subjects of spirituality. And remember that he's surrounded by this crowd that is jostling for position so they can get near to him to hear, because right now he's not preaching to the crowd. He's just talking to some disciples around him. So this guy elbows his way to the front and interrupts Jesus and says, verse 13, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." Okay? Just totally random, out of the blue, "Tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." Now, let me say this right up front to the guests and newcomers, those of you who are new to our church. I was once part of a church in Florida many years ago that spent the whole month of January cranking out in every possible way, in Sunday school and the sermons and in small groups, and cranking out on the issue of money. And I didn't realize it back then, but we were careful about it, but we were subtly pressuring people into giving money. And I remember being uncomfortable about that, even though I didn't fully realize the extent to which we were doing that. And so one of my vows since that time was that I would never do that. And so we don't do that as a church here. But when the Bible talks about money, as you're preaching through a book, then you have to talk about money. You can't just skip that part, right? That's true for any subject of Scripture. You don't skip the parts that you don't like and just dwell on the parts that you do like. So this particular section here is called the Parable of the Rich Fool. And it's all about the foolishness of greed. It's about, it doesn't talk so much about giving money as about our heart attitude toward money, toward finances. And so we're going to talk about this, but I wanted to be upfront with you who are new here, because I don't want you to think that, oh, this is another church that just talks about money all the time, because we're not, and we don't do that. But we can't avoid it when God brings it up. So in our study through Luke, we're in verse 13, and this guy interrupts Jesus. And by the way, this is not an uncommon request for a Jewish rabbi, for a Jewish teacher to receive. As these guys walked around and they preached into the different villages, people would bring their gripes to them, right? And they would ask them to act as judges. They would lay out both sides of the whatever the problem was, and the rabbi would make a decision, right? But I want you to notice, this guy is not asking for that. He is not asking, hear both sides and make a decision. He is giving Jesus an order. He's giving Jesus an order. Tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me. Right? So that begins to tell you a little bit about his heart. Now, one thing about Jesus is, of course, he's God, so he knows exactly what's going on inside all of us. He knew what was going on inside this guy. And if you will notice, as you read the New Testament, people who don't have an open heart don't get a lot of the warm fuzzies from Jesus. Right? We've already discovered that quite a bit. And it's not that he's unloving, but sometimes the loving thing to do to somebody like this guy is not to grant him his request, but to challenge him with the wrongness of his heart attitude. And that's exactly what Jesus is going to do. Jesus refuses to be Judge Judy to this guy. So he says, man, verse 14, man, who made me a judge or arbitrator over you? There's more important things that he's going to go after than the amount of money that this guy thinks he deserves. Okay? So, I love what Haddon Robinson says about this guy. I'll quote it to you. Talking about the heart attitude of this fella. The birds would never sing again for him. The flowers would never bloom again. The sun would never shine again as brightly until somehow he got what he thought was his fair share of the inheritance. See, that's his heart attitude. And Jesus is saying, you've missed it, man. I've been talking about some really important things, and I'm not going to lower myself to being Judge Judy for you and your brother. Okay? So, here's the principle. Verse 15. And he said to them, notice now he's shifting. He's using it like Jesus does so many times. This is a great teaching moment. Okay? He shifts back to his disciples. He says to them, take care and be on your guard. That is very strong language in the Greek here. I mean, this is really be watchful. And the be on your guard part was a military term. Okay? So it's strong language. Jesus says, you really need to be watching out for this. You really need to be careful about this, all against all covetousness. For one's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. Now that's the principle, and then he's going to tell a parable. He's going to tell a story to illustrate that principle. But now, would you agree with me that that principle goes against everything ingrained in our culture? Right? Even those of us who have been believers a long time have trouble not judging people according to their possessions, how much money they have, what kind of car they drive, what what neighborhood they live in, and so forth. So, but here's the originator of creation, Jesus Christ himself, the member of the Trinity who had the most to do with creation, and he said, when I set this up, here's the way I set it up. Your life, and the word for life there is Zoe, which means your real life, your contentment, your passion, your satisfaction in life. Your life, the reality of who you are, does not depend on the stuff you have. Now, I hope you will be brutally honest with yourself, as I was forced to be this week. And realize that I am contaminated in this on this subject by a culture with 10,000 seductive voices that come at me day in and day out. It's the ads on ads on TV and the ads on the radio and the newspaper ads, and it's everywhere. Everywhere we are surrounded by, you need to buy this. You need to buy that. And there's always the, you know, whether they use a cute puppy like Budweiser just did, with their Super Bowl ad, or they use a sensual woman, or they you know, whatever they use, it's always, the message is always, you got to have this, you need this in order to have real life. And then our culture is economically structured along the same lines. I'll give you an example. This just happened to us this week. My wife, I get a text from my lovely wife. She says, I have a washer full of clothes and it died. Okay? And my first thought is, I wish I wasn't your husband right now. You know, be nice if somebody else had to deal with that. So I take the washer, with the help of my friend Roy here, I take the washer to the repair guy, and the repair guy is like, oh, you got 5 years out of that? You're fortunate. Right? And you know what that's called? Planned obsolescence. Okay? And there's a lot of items in our culture that are built that way. Now, we have had washers that have lasted 15, 20, 25 years in the past. But the guy says, that is a thing of the past, right? You got 5 years out of it, you did pretty good. And so this is where we live as people in the United States of America, that kind of culture. Now, let me say one other thing before I move on, because some people have gone too far the other extreme, and they think that somehow poverty is a holy thing, right? And so they don't deal with the finances that God does provide for them in the right way, and they think poverty, and you know, they even sanctify it with laziness, and they think that's a good thing. Well, no, that's not a good thing either. But God never condemns wealth in the Bible. In fact, some of the people that He greatly blessed in the Bible were very wealthy people. Abraham, in his culture, was a tremendously wealthy man. God blessed and used him. Job, right? Job was very rich. He lost it all. And then because he went through the trial correctly, God gave him even more at the end. Tremendously wealthy man. David and Solomon were very rich kings. You get over the New Testament, you have a rich guy by the name of Joseph of Arimathea that has a tomb that has never been used that they are able to bury Jesus in. And then you had rich people in the New Testament who had larger houses where the church met before there were church buildings. So, you know, God never condemns people who are wealthy. He just warns them. Don't trust in your wealth. Don't think you're better than anybody else, because your life does not consist of the things that you possess. You know why else this is hard in our culture? Yeah, I had a real struggle with this whole thing this week. And one of the things that I believe God led me to is remember your past. How were you raised? My guess is that 95% of the people sitting in this room are better off today than the way you were raised. Is that not true? You know, I would love to ask for a raise of hands right now. How many of you are poorer today than you were as a child? And I might get two or three hands, would be my guess. All right? I see one hand. All right. You're poorer today than you were as a child. But that is the exception rather than the rule. I was raised in a third world country, And then I spent time in Florida, and all of that time was without air conditioning in Cuba and Florida. We didn't have air conditioning. We had old cars. We had, you know, there was no steak. Hamburger was this is in the United States, once we came to the United States. In Cuba, we actually lived pretty good. We were a member of the upper middle class till Castro came in and ruined it all. Okay? But anyway, that's another story. You went from even though we didn't have air conditioning, I remember the first time I felt air conditioning, it was at Woolworth in Havana, downtown Havana. They had a Woolworth. We called it El Tenseng, which is Spanglish for the 10 cents. Remember when Woolworth had the 10-cent sign? All right. So anyway, I'm probably 5 or 6 years old, and I walk into Woolworth, and I think, whoa, this is nice, right? Because I'd never felt air conditioning before in my life. So anyway, we lived very, very simply here in the United States as an immigrant family. And there was a time when, I've told you this before, there was a time in our lives when a Sunday newspaper and a pack of double mint gum was a luxury. That was our luxury for the week, and there were no other luxuries. And so I look at my life now, and I live way better now than I used to back then. And I would guess that is the case with most of you who are hearing my voice right now. Some of you have already gone to sleep. Bless your hearts. All right. Oh, I forgot to give you this quote. This is a great, great quote. Let me see if I still have it here somewhere. Nope, it went away. Here it is. Some wag has described preaching as the fine art of talking in someone else's sleep. And we have some of that every week here in this fine congregation. I'd love to run your pictures right across them. But see, this is why it's hard for us, because our standard of living slowly rises and we get used to it, and it's like the frog in the kettle thing, and we don't like it when it goes back down, right? And of course, during these last difficult economic times, many people have had to deal with that issue, but we don't like it, and we grow accustomed to a certain level, and I would not want to go back to that time in my life when a luxury was a pack of double mint gum and a Sunday paper. No, I don't want to be back there. And a lot of tomato soup and cheese sandwiches. Don't ever feed me tomato soup. So this is, what I'm trying to get us to agree on here is that all of us struggle with this issue here, to one extent or another. All of us do. So here's the story. Now, Jesus tells them a parable, and a parable, the literal meaning of parable is to set alongside. And what he's talking about is a story that you set alongside the principle to expand on or explain the principle. The principle is your life doesn't consist of the abundance of your possessions. Your life is not about stuff. That's not what makes you happy. I had all kinds of statistics that I researched about countries in the world, that the happiest countries in the world. The United States is number 33, even though we have, you know, the highest or close to the highest standard of living. And many of the countries that have... they don't have squat. They mentioned Panama. Panama was like number 90 on the GDP is what gross, what's GDP? Gross domestic product. And yet, these people in Panama, they're really happy. Right? What right do they have to be happy? They don't have nothing. All right. So, it's not about possessions. All right, verse 16, he told them a parable saying, the land of a rich man produced plentifully. Now, notice what Jesus does not say. This guy was not a crook. This guy is a farmer, and he's a good farmer. He's a skilled farmer, and his land produces bountifully. He gets a great crop. So there's nothing wrong in the way he gets this crop, right? And he thought to himself, he's got a decision to make now, right? You get an inheritance, or you get extra money, or you get a raise. Okay, what am I going to do with this extra stuff that I'm not used to? What shall I do? For I have nowhere to store my crops. Oh, this is great. This will hit some of you. How many of you have stuff? Don't raise your hand. How many of you have stuff right now in storage? I'm not talking about just your garage. Okay, I'm talking about storage units. This is from the New York Times Magazine. United States has 2.3 billion square feet of self-storage space. That's more than 7 square feet for every man, woman, and child. Okay? If you don't have one, you're missing your 7 square feet of storage space. It's now physically possible that every American could stand all at the same time under the total canopy of self-storage roofing. There are 51,000 storage facilities, more than 7 times the number of Starbucks. 50% of storage renters store stuff that wouldn't fit in their homes, even though the size of the average American home has doubled in the last 50 years. Okay, the houses that I remember growing up, most of them are, again, smaller than the house that I live in right now. All right, 15% of customers told the Self Storage Association that they were storing items they, quote, no longer need or want. Okay, 15%. I'm storing items I no longer need or want. So why are you storing them? I don't know. It's stuff. I need stuff. Right? Somehow stuff makes me feel better. So this guy has that problem. What's he going to do? He's got a big harvest. Where's he going to put it? He can't, you know, if you know anything about farming, farmers like to control the results of their harvest so that all the corn doesn't flood the market at the same time, because what does that do? It brings the price of corn down. Okay? So, you know, this is, I could go on and on that, about that, but I think you get the idea. This is the way our economy works in the United States. You save some of your crop, you store it, and you let it out slowly according to the price of whatever, you know, whatever they're paying for corn or beans or whatever. All right. So he says, verse 18, I will do this. I will tear down my barns and build larger ones, and there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, that always cracks me up. You know, he doesn't, I know I'm going beyond the story, and you know, but there's no family involved here, right? It's just him talking to himself. And in verses 16 through 18, there are 8 I's and 4 my's. 8 I's, I, my. Okay, 8 I's and 4 my's. So the point that Jesus is making in there, and we could read it that way, and he said, I will do this, I will tear down my barns and build larger, you know, we could emphasize that, but it's obvious what Jesus is trying to get across here. This is a totally self-centered man who has put all his trust in his money. And then, verse 19, I will say to my soul, soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, be merry. You know what that defines? That defines many, many American goals for retirement. A lot of people are defined by that when they think about retirement. I'm going to work real hard. I'm going to put a lot of stuff away. And then I'm going to retire. And then I'm going to relax. And I'm going to eat, drink, and be merry. That's called hedonism. Okay, I'm just going to party, do whatever I want. And notice what God's response to him is in verse 20. But God said to him, fool. And the word fool in the Bible is often used to describe somebody who lives their life without God. Now notice I didn't say they believe or don't believe in God. I said who lives their life without God. There are people who believe in God who live their life as practical atheists, right? They say they believe in God, but Their life doesn't demonstrate that. This is a good example of that. God said to him, "Fool, this night your soul is required of you, and the things you have prepared, whose will they be?" This is a nightmare of the materialist, the nightmare of the person who said, "I worked real hard all my life, and I'm going to, you know, save all this money and enjoy all this money," and all of a sudden Jesus says, "Wait, you're going to die, and then somebody else is going to get all your stuff." Right? And in Ecclesiastes, Solomon has an interesting conversation about this kind of thing. Ecclesiastes 2:18 and 19, here's what it says. And remember, Ecclesiastes is practical atheism, a man living his life without God. Okay? That's the whole book. "Thus I hated all the fruit of my labor, for which I had labored under the sun, for I must leave it to the man who will come after me, and who knows whether he'll be a wise man or a fool." So, you know, I worked so hard to get all this loot, and I'm going to die, and I'm going to leave it to somebody else, and who knows what he's going to do with it, right? "Yet he will have control over all the fruit of my labor, for which I have labored for acting wisely under the sun. This too is vanity." Right? So this is the worst nightmare of this guy. You know, you're going to die. Somebody else is going to. And, you know, we go back to the original interruption. Right? Two brothers fighting over an inheritance. And no doubt the guy who asked the question is conscious of what Jesus is saying here. So, whose will those things be? And then verse 21. "So is the one who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God." Now, if you notice this, Jesus has been going after the heart attitude. Throughout this whole thing, it's about the heart attitude. Only at the very end, in that last phrase, does he give the antidote, the solution. What's the solution? You know, to be rich toward God. How would you define that in your life? What does it mean for you to be rich toward God? You know, in this farmer's case, well, he could have raised the wages of the people who helped him farm the land. He could have gone right around them to dozens of villages in Palestine that were very poor, where people were just scraping by. He could have built them wells so that they wouldn't have to walk miles to get water. He could have done all kinds of things rather than build bigger barns and store it. Right? But he doesn't do that. Why? Because we've already seen it's all about I, me, me, me. And so you see Jesus going after the heart attitude of the guy over and over and over and over and over again. Okay. I got sidetracked. Excuse me for just a minute. Okay. So, what do we do about this? If you're honest enough to admit, it's very probable that I have been infected to one degree or another with the way our society looks at money, the way our society looks at stuff. What do we do about that? Because it's just so totally, totally pervasive. I always love the guy that said, "You never saw a hearse pulling a U-Haul," right? You can't take it with you, but you can send it on ahead. And that's what the phrase "rich toward God" is all about, right? We can give. And there's always a tension in this, right? Because you have the verse where the scriptures say, God gives us all good things to enjoy. And then you have all the verses that talk about sacrificial giving and giving to God. And there's always this tension. What does it mean? Where should I be at? How do I evaluate my life? You know, how much do I keep and how much do I give? How much do I save? Because God is not against saving. God is not against preparing for retirement. The issue, again, goes back to heart attitude. You know, am I saving for retirement because I want to be able to trust my money and not God? Or, you know, am I being prudent? And there's no black and white here. So it forces us to wrestle over and over again with scriptures like this. So number one, let me give you some practical thoughts. Four ways that we need to be vigilant against greed. Number one, we need to recognize our vulnerability. We already talked a little bit about that. We live in the red zone of the affluenza disease. 10 years ago, two sociologists described the word affluence with influenza. You know, they combined those two words and they came up with the word affluenza. Some of you have probably heard that word before. They even wrote a book about it. And it came out in a PBS documentary too. But the whole idea was that, you know, we make ourselves miserable in America by trying to keep up with the Joneses and by trying to always get more and more and more and more. That's called affluenza. In 1986, the authors note, there were more high schools than shopping centers in our country. Just 20 years later, there are twice as many shopping centers as there are high schools. Think about that. Let me run that by you again because, you know, a statistic is just an indicator of culture and society. In 1986, there were more high schools than shopping centers in our country. Fast forward 20 years, there are now twice as many shopping centers as there are high schools. What does that say about us, right? Now, if you lived in California, you would prepare for earthquakes and brush fires and slides. I don't know why anybody lives in California. But, you know, they have certain building codes if you live in California. If you live in South Florida and, you know, you have building codes now, they didn't used to, but you have building codes to prepare for hurricanes, right? But, you know, Christians living in America at the start of the 21st century, we have to face the great spiritual danger of materialism and greed. It's in the very air that we breathe. So we need to be aware of it. We must guard against all kinds of greed. That's number two. We must guard against all kinds of greed. Did you notice that Jesus said, be on your guard against all covetousness, all greed, because there's different kinds. Let me give you an example. My history is that I usually drive later model cars, right? So I can pat myself on the back and say, here, you know, I'm not greedy. I don't drive brand new fancy cars. I have a friend who always drives late, and this is a pastor, and always drives late model cars and will not let his wife drive his car. I'm serious. His car is always spotless, inside and out. And his wife can't touch it. And so I can pat myself in the back and say, I don't have a problem with cars, you know. I drive old cars all the time. In fact, there was a time in my life when I was proud of driving a ghetto cruiser, what we call ghetto cruisers in Wisconsin. In Wisconsin, they call them winter cars. You know, they put their nice cars away in the winter and drive ghetto cruisers during the winter. Anyway, so I can pat myself on the back because I don't have a problem with that, right? But what about other areas of my life? I had to take a really good look this week at where is the greed in my life? Because what we do is we're specialists at seeing the greed in other people's lives, right? I mean, that's really easy to spot. But what about the greed in my life? Where is that? Some of you want me to tell you. I'm not going to tell you. You need to do your own self-examination, right? Where is the greed in your life? Where is the greed in my life? You can be broke and greedy. It's not as much fun, but you can still be broke and greedy, right? We draw this caricature of greed as we see it in other people, and we say, well, I'm not like that, right? Here's some questions for you concerning other potential areas of greed. It might just take the form of wanting more stuff or better stuff than what you have. You're always thinking about the next thing that you want to buy, the next thing you want to get. For somebody else, you know, they may not buy a ton of stuff, but when you buy something, you have to have the absolute best, or it has to be a particular brand that feeds your ego. Not just because the brand is, you know, a better buy. You won't settle for anything less. Greed is expressed not in lavish lifestyle, but in a craving to have a huge amount of savings that gives you a sense of security. That's another form of greed. Another form of greed is just a desire to keep all I have and not share, not give to God, not give to people who are in need. So there's all different areas of greed, and Jesus says you need to be on the lookout for them all. Okay? Number three, from a practical point of view, we need to have our own financial house in order. If you don't think carefully about a budget, about planning how you're going to save, what you're going to spend, what you're going to keep, what you're going to put away, what you're going to give to God, you are more susceptible to being tempted by greed because there's no plan, and so there's fear that there's no plan, right? Then number four, we need to push back against materialism. We need to push back against materialism. This statistic blew me away. Listen to this one. Our children are being targeted at younger and younger ages. From 1980 to 2004, the amount spent on children's advertising in America rose from, okay, 1980, 2004, 1980, $100 million a year people spent trying to get your kids to buy you their favorite toys. In 2004, $15 billion. From $100 million to $15 billion advertising dollars to try to get your kids to develop greed before they even realize it. See, our culture is vested in this whole idea of getting us to want more and more and more. And so in light of that, we need to push back against materialism. We can't, as Christians, we can't be passive about it. We can't just say, oh, you know, that's okay, that's out there and it doesn't affect me. No, it will. We need to push back. We need to examine our lives and our homes. We need to ask ourselves continually, could I make do with less? What are some areas that I could cut? Where am I senselessly going along with a consumer more is better mentality? Could I be more rich and generous toward God and others if I were willing to be more restrained in my spending habits? Those are important questions that we need to wrestle with. That, you know, again, I go back to that tension. It takes some brutal honesty sometimes. Parents, some of us are parents and grandparents. Are we teaching our children? Are we training our children to have discernment about greed in their own hearts? Are we helping them understand, again, age appropriate, at how our culture would like for them to become little buying machines? We got to have those conversations. Have I adopted the mindset that I have to spend money to have a good time? That's an interesting question, isn't it? You know, the only way to have a good time is to go somewhere and spend money and someone else entertain me. Well, those are just some levels of application that flow right out of this passage. You know, and of course, the last thought, the punchline, is Jesus saying, this is what the person is who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. And then there's that other verse that says, don't lay up for yourself treasures on earth where moth and rust doth corrupt. I love that King James. Moth and rust doth corrupt. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven where nobody can touch it. Nobody can touch it. And the way we lay up treasures in heaven is to be rich toward God. The way you apply that in your own life says a lot about the condition of your heart, which is what this whole passage is about. Let's pray. Father, we want to be honest before you in the way that we deal with what we realize first comes from you. You have placed us as managers over a certain amount of income, a certain amount of possessions. And we want to be people who are faithful managers, faithful stewards. Because we believe the scripture that says it's required in stewards that a man be found faithful. And so we want to be like those faithful household managers in the New Testament who managed what they did not own for someone else, but managed it efficiently and managed it in a way that the master would be pleased with them. So Lord, I pray you give us wisdom, give us self-honesty and wisdom in how each of us deals with that. Thank you that you are not a God who is oppressive, the way many churches have represented you as far as giving and finances, but you are a God of grace. You're a God who comes after our hearts first before you go after our wallets. We want to be people whose hearts are right with you in this area as well as every other area of our lives. In Jesus' name, amen.